this genocidal state and its attack on Gaza just continues and continues. And of course, the reason is that if we need to come to terms with Israeli settler colonialism, with this idea that there can't remain Palestinians, right, in Israel, that Moshe Feiglin has articulated via Hitler, right? If we need to come to terms with Israeli settler colonialism since 48, and actually even before it, until Israel's destructive assault on Gaza, that really means that we have to come to terms with settler colonialism more broadly, also in the United States and in other places. And who wants to do that? And that's why we're seeing, that's part of the reason also that we're seeing this horrific attack also against Jews right now, intensifying more and more, including against me in this case, right? Because anything in order not to really come to terms to open this Pandora box for the West of settler colonialism and settler colonial genocide that we're all witnessing now. This is the reason that the Biden administration continues to support Israel, whatever happens.
Raz Siegel, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Israeli-American historian. Earlier this month, the University of Minnesota rescinded its offer to him to head its Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. He's currently Associate Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University and Endowed Professor in the Study of Modern Genocide. That does it for our show. A very fond farewell to our digital fellow, Eric Halverson, and our intern, Soledad Aguilar-Colón, and Hannah Fitz. We will miss you so, so much. You are now part of our DNA, the Democracy Now! Alumni. We're currently accepting applications for Director of Development. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's board of directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, June 24th at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, federal officials formally recognize the harm to Native tribes created by damming Northwest rivers for the first time. An initiative to increase corporate taxes and give every Oregonian $750 a year will likely make the November ballot. And Oregon has a new state Senate Majority Leader, Kathleen Taylor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 18th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. The U.S. government has formally acknowledged the harm that the construction of dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers have done to Native tribes. It's the first time the federal government has made those impacts clear after decades of Native tribes fighting the dam's construction and operation. A new report details how the dams devastated salmon runs, inundated villages and burial grounds, and how they continue to get in the way of tribes' ability to exercise their treaty fishing rights. This comes after the Biden administration committed $1 billion to restoring regional salmon runs before more of them go extinct. That money would also go towards more renewable energy construction to replace that of the hydropower dams if and when those are breached. Tom Iverson is regional coordinator for Yakima Nation Fisheries. Iverson said, quote, this administration has moved forward with aggressive action to rebalance some of the transfer of wealth. The salmon were the wealth of the river. What we've seen is the transfer of the wealth to farmers, to loggers, to hydropower systems, to the detriment of tribes, end quote. Oregon's plans for investing $689 million in infrastructure to provide high-speed internet to all Oregonians is moving forward. The federal government is distributing $42 billion to states to increase internet access across the country. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The stage is set for a massive investment in Oregon's plans to bring high-speed internet to everyone in the state. The second volume of Oregon's Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Proposal has been approved by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, laying out its plan for investing nearly $700 million in federal funding. Oregon Broadband Office Director Nick Batts says the goal is internet for all.
This is a historic investment. We've never seen this much money invested in broadband by the federal government before. I'm not sure that we're ever going to see it again. And if we're successful, we're not going to need it again.
Batts notes that high-speed internet connectivity is crucial, enabling everything from remote work to telemedicine appointments, and is especially important in rural parts of the state. Batts says the state will now begin the process of selecting the grantees that will build the infrastructure to locations that are unserved or underserved.
The goal of this challenge process is to identify every location in Oregon that is eligible to receive BEAD funding. So by the end of this challenge process, we will have a master list of all these locations. It's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 120, 130, 140,000 locations.
Funding to increase broadband access has become available through the passage of Congress's bipartisan infrastructure law. The Biden administration is currently in the process of distributing more than $42 billion to states to increase high-speed internet connectivity. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon voters are likely to have another initiative to consider on the ballot this November. If passed, it would create a 3% tax on mega corporation sales and then redistribute that money to each Oregon resident, roughly $750 a year. Organizers of Initiative Petition 17 say they likely have enough signatures to get it on the ballot this fall. The 3% corporate tax would apply to companies that have sales in Oregon above $25 million, and the payout would go to Oregonians of all ages. The campaign is called Oregon People's Rebate, and they hope to give a financial boost to help Oregon families buy groceries, afford rent, and pay for basic necessities. The proposal says that any additional money left over from the tax would, quote, be used to provide additional funding for services for senior citizens, healthcare, public early childhood education, and public kindergarten through grade 12 education, end quote. Business groups in Oregon are preparing to fight the measure, saying higher corporate taxes would lead to higher costs of goods and services. One organizer with Oregon People's Rebate, Anna Martinez, told the Oregonian, quote, "It's a tale as old as time. Corporations don't want to pay their fair share. They pay so little compared to everyday Oregonians. We all have really thin margins, and we manage to do it," end quote. Signatures collected for the initiative will have to be certified by the Secretary of State before it will officially be on Oregonians' ballots in November. Petitioners say they have about 18,000 more signatures than they technically need. Good governance groups say claims of non-citizen voting are untrue and dangerous. They say that such allegations and calls for new laws to protect election integrity could plant potentially dangerous seeds of doubt among some voters if their candidate doesn't win the 2024 presidential election. Eric Galatis has more.
After a recent flurry of claims that Democrats are allowing immigrants to the country illegally in order to register them to vote in the upcoming U.S. presidential election, good governance groups are crying disinformation. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says these claims are not only untrue, but could plant potentially dangerous seeds of doubt among some voters about the legitimacy of November's election results.
Non-citizens are already not legally allowed to vote in federal elections. This has been the case through American history, and it was codified into American law in 1996.
House Republicans have introduced new legislation requiring proof of citizenship to vote after claims that a skyrocketing number of new voters are registering without a photo ID in key swing states. But election officials in states including Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Texas have debunked those claims. Becker says while each state manages its own elections locally, locally, the Help America Vote Act, passed in 2002, already requires valid forms of identification before people can be registered to vote anywhere in the United States.
Either a driver's license number or a social security number, which gets matched back to your record, so you don't get to be registered and cast a ballot unless you provided this ID.
Becker says data show that non-citizen voting is virtually a non-existent phenomenon, in part because people who risked life and limb to find a better life in America know they would be immediately deported if caught. Trying to vote illegally would put a giant target on their backs.
To cast one ballot in an election in which 160 million ballots are going to be cast. It happens exceedingly rarely, largely because the states and federal government already have really good policies in place.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
The Oregon State Senate has a new majority leader, Senator Kathleen Taylor of Southeast Portland. That makes her the second in command of the legislative chamber, starting on July 15th. Current Democratic Majority Leader Kate Lieber of Beaverton will step down from the position to become a co-chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Taylor wrote in a statement, quote, "I'm grateful to Senator Lieber for her service and for leading the Senate Democratic Caucus to deliver major wins for the people of Oregon. I look forward to supporting our caucus and collaborating with my fellow legislative leaders to make Oregon the best place to live, work, and raise a family." End quote. The U.S. House passes the National Defense Authorization Act with hard right amendments. Political scientists say they worry a second Trump presidency could break American democracy, and farmers voice their concerns about the Farm Bill. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
On this vote, the yeas are 217, the nays are 199. The bill is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
The House of Representatives passed the $900 billion National Defense Authorization Act, but it faces an uphill battle in the Senate. House Republicans included amendments blocking the Pentagon from reimbursing troops seeking abortions, blocking funds to cover gender-affirming care, and ending diversity measures. Other amendments call for defunding a U.S. military humanitarian aid pier off Gaza's coast. At a Turning Point USA Action conference over the weekend, Steve Bannon, a close ally of former President Donald Trump, called for, quote, victory or death, unquote, in the election. He also repeated Trump's threat to use the Justice Department to go after their opponents. Political scientists say they're growing increasingly worried about whether U.S. democracy can withstand future challenges, particularly from a second Trump presidency. Harvard professor Stephen Levitsky says the Republican Party no longer abides by longstanding democratic norms.
It must unambiguously accept the results of elections, it must unambiguously reject the use of political violence, and it must be willing to break completely with violent or anti-democratic forces.
At the Turning Point USA conference, the former president said he would stop assisting Ukraine in their war against Russia and called Ukraine's war a scam. Also, RNC co-chair Laura Trump reaffirmed threats made by her father-in-law to go after anyone who they think is cheating in the election.
If you cheat in an election, we will find you, we will track you down, and we will prosecute you to the full extent of the law.
Reports before and after the 2016 and 2020 elections, including studies commissioned by the Trump administration, have shown voter fraud is extremely rare. Consumer advocates say they're opposed to a bill dealing with cryptocurrency. The Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century Act puts its regulation under the Commodity Futures Trading Commission instead of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Mark Hayes is with Americans for Financial Reform.
You're basically creating a more permissive regulatory regime that allows crypto businesses to do basically what they do with a patina of protection, but it actually doesn't provide the same kind of protections you get if you simply dealt with them the way we do now.
The House is finalizing its version of the Farm Bill with big fights expected in the Senate over hunger programs and other items. Smaller farmers and ranchers say they're worried about cuts to the climate and conservation programs they use, especially reductions in grants for small operations. And Barb Kalbaugh, a fourth-generation Iowa family farmer, says big subsidies are increasingly tilted toward huge factory farms and combined feeding operations.
Industrial scale factory farms, even though they're industrial scale, they do not have to go by industrial standards. They go by ag standards. And that's why we have the problem with pollution that we have. That should be addressed in the Farm Bill.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, will distribute $1 billion to underserved, climate-vulnerable communities. The funds will be used for updating sewer systems, managing wildfire-prone forests, and other resilience projects. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As climate disasters get worse, the federal government is working to ensure that the people who are most vulnerable get the support they need.
What we're seeing is that more and more communities are dealing with the impacts and consequences of climate change. And that impact is falling disproportionately on underserved and disadvantaged communities.
Victoria Salinas is with FEMA. Last fall, the agency identified almost 500 census districts across the country as community disaster resilience zones. These zones are found in all 50 states and were chosen based on a community's exposure to climate-related hazards and its socioeconomic vulnerability. This year, FEMA will distribute $1 billion in grants to support resilience projects, such as upgrading stormwater systems or managing forests to reduce the risk of wildfires. Disaster resilience zones have priority for this funding, and FEMA will cover a larger share of a project's cost in these communities.
So that's a big benefit because it means they're able to accomplish what they want to do for their community with more federal support.
So the program aims to help the communities most vulnerable to climate change have the resources they need to prepare. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth on the history and importance of Juneteenth. At 6, it's Trans Positive PDX. Then at 7, it's a very special LGBTQ+ panel live from the KBOO studio in honor of Pride Month. Tonight's episode will be a conversation among and about the queer BIPOC community. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be bright and sunny with a high of 84. Today in history, in 2024, the Senate of Thailand votes to approve the Equality Marriage Bill into law. This makes Thailand the first country in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, to legalize same-sex marriage. The quote of the day is from American film critic Roger Ebert, born on this day in 1942. He said, quote, "I believe we are born with our minds open to wonderful experiences and only slowly learn to limit ourselves to narrow tastes. We're taught to lose our curiosity by the bludgeon blows of mass marketing, which brainwash us to see hits and discourage exploration." The federal government plans to spend nearly $13 million on water projects in two South Dakota communities. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has awarded two communities in South Dakota with grants to help with water projects. Kathleen Shannon has more.
Nearly $13 million in Water Smart Drought Resiliency grants are slated for projects in Eagle Butte and Dade County. The Miniwash Day Water Company, run by the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, will receive $2.8 million to pipe water 10 miles northwest of the community to supply 17 existing residences and 20 being constructed. The water company started planning this project in 1993, according to Executive Director Leo Fisher. In the meantime, he says, the people living there have had to haul their water.
It's more of a pain than it is anything because you haul it in the back of a vehicle. In wintertime, everything freezes up.
Piped water is important in the region because area groundwater wells are of poor quality, must run deep into the ground, and have proven unreliable. To the east, the Webb Water Development Association is slated to receive nearly $10 million to build about 40 miles of pipeline, supplying over 700 people with drinking water in the city of Wabay and in rural Dade County. The Bureau of Reclamation has made WaterSmart grants in 11 states this year.
That was Kathleen Shannon reporting. Fancy Dance is premiering this week in select theaters before streaming on Apple TV+. The film follows Jax, played by Lily Gladstone, who's searching for her missing sister, Towie, while she also cares for her niece, Roki, played by Isabel DeRoy Olsen, on the Seneca Cayuga Reservation in Oklahoma. During a press junket this week, we asked Gladstone about the film raising awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Gladstone says the film Finding a Home with Apple brings the issue to a larger audience.
You're hard-pressed to find any Indigenous person that's not touched by this epidemic. Like, we all know somebody, we're all close with somebody, we're all close with somebody who was close with somebody. So it's nothing new to us, but I know that with Killers of the Flower Moon coming out last year, it was a bit of an introduction of this deeper history to a larger audience. And one of the things that came out of it, at least from my view, when I was spoken to because of the character I was carrying in that, the woman I was portraying in that, people were left wanting more of her story, more of her sister's story. And while Fancy Dance was... It premiered 10 months prior to Killers of the Flower Moon at Sundance in January that same year. It reached audiences first, although a smaller audience. By the end of the year after Killers had come out, people were talking about how they felt like these films needed to be seen in tandem.
Gladstone says the film addresses missing and murdered Indigenous people in a compassionate way.
When the audience is invited into this story, I think it's a very important way to approach this issue because we don't show any bodies being brutalized. It's not about the ins and outs of the case. Nobody's trying to prove Towie's humanity. It's you learn about her and how missed she is, how valued she is, how loved she is by her absence and by the people who miss her. You see what happens in reality, that it's women and people from our own communities who take up the grassroots initiative to search for our missing relatives. When the jurisdiction falls with the FBI, they're not the ones that are taking the necessary action. So it's a way of learning about this epidemic in a very compassionate way, a very inside-out way. You learn about the inequities through the obstacles the characters face.
Fancy Dance premieres Friday in select theaters before streaming on Apple TV Plus on June 28th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Biden administration has tried to broker a ceasefire, an ultimate end to the Israel-Hamas war. But as one commentator observes, it hasn't been even-handed, with the White House blaming Hamas while publicly ignoring Israel's rejection of Biden's terms. He maintains the U.S. needs to be equally firm on both sides. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In my commentary last week, I said the Biden peace proposal to end the Israel-Hamas war didn't have a ghost of a chance of being accepted by either side. Israel, I said, has made clear that it will not trade ending the war on Hamas for the release of all the hostages, nor will it agree to a permanent ceasefire unless and until Hamas is completely destroyed. That means, first, that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, will continue with operations to reduce the Rafah area to rubble in search of Hamas fighters, and that Israel plans to make a major thrust into the West Bank and possibly Lebanon to subdue Hezbollah. A week has passed and much has happened to dampen expectations even further. The Biden administration's efforts to broker an agreement by sending Secretary of State Antony Blinken on countless expeditions to the Middle East have failed. Blinken blames Hamas and pretends that Israel has been on board all along. Israel accepted the proposal as it was, he said. Hamas could have answered with a single word, yes. At some point in a negotiation, and this has gone back and forth for a long time, you get to a point where if one side, Hamas, continues to change its demands, including making demands and insisting on changes for things it had already accepted, you have to question whether they're proceeding in good faith or not. It's time for the haggling to stop and a ceasefire to start. It's as simple as that, Blinken concluded. That position is inaccurate and terribly one-sided. Israel has never fully accepted the Biden proposal because it would impose a permanent ceasefire, just as the IDF is seeking to completely destroy Hamas in the Rafah area to the south and in northern Gaza. Nor does the Netanyahu government accept the idea of Israel's complete withdrawal from Gaza in phase one of Biden's proposal. As for Hamas constantly making new demands, it answers as follows, quote, "We reacted positively to Biden's speech, but at the same time we heard nothing from Netanyahu except an intention to continue the war. The Netanyahu government continued to refuse any permanent ceasefire, contrary to the Security Council's resolution. Blinken said that Israel agreed to the latest proposal, but we have not heard such agreement from any senior Israeli official. We call on Blinken and the Biden administration to put pressure on the Israeli government." That was Hamas's official statement, which, by the way, I have not seen published in any major U.S. newspaper. Further complicating matters, Israel seems intent on expanding operations in the West Bank and Lebanon against Hezbollah, another point I raised last week. The Israeli government has rejected a French proposal that Israel and the U.S. join with France in a plan that would halt the ongoing exchanges of fire between Israel and Hezbollah. The plan, as reported by the New York Times, June 14, is for a diplomatic engagement with Hezbollah and, quote, a framework that includes a smaller buffer zone of roughly 6 miles from Lebanon's border with Israel and an increase in the number of Lebanese army troops stationed in the border area. Israel told French President Macron to stuff it, saying the plan was, quote, hostile to Israel. When he first presented his proposal May 31st, President Biden said it is time for this war to end. Now Blinken says it's time for the haggling to stop. Nowhere, however, do we have a U.S. official saying that Israel either has to get serious about talks with Hamas if it wants the hostages released, or face real consequences in terms of U.S. aid and political support. All the leverage belongs to Prime Minister Netanyahu and his far-right cabinet. At the same time, Hamas, according to one unconfirmed report, is asking that the U.S. provide a written guarantee of Israel's withdrawal from Gaza and adherence to a ceasefire. The White House evidently hasn't responded to this quite reasonable request. Thus, the war will go on with more civilian casualties, more starvation in Gaza, more U.S. weapons deliveries to Israel, more intense fighting in northern Gaza and Lebanon, and more war crimes by both sides, as the United Nations Commission has just determined. One Israeli commentator succinctly summarizes the negotiating situation this way, quote, "Hamas is not ready for a deal without ending the war, and the Netanyahu government is not ready for a deal that ends the war," unquote. Hamas demands to know at the start that there will be a permanent ceasefire and guaranteed Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. The Netanyahu government wants to make sure Hamas doesn't rise again before agreeing to those demands, and thereby hopes to ensure its political future. And the United States is unwilling to make a real difference by addressing those conflicting positions even-handedly. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, your stories, and your tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Mark Moran, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Galatas, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Juneteenth is a federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. It's celebrated on June 19th because that's the day in 1865 when Major General Gordon Granger ordered the final enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation in Galveston, Texas at the end of the Civil War. But some commentators believe that many of today's Juneteenth celebrations have lost their political edge. Marsha Coleman Adebayo is the president of the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition in Maryland. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg earlier this month about the true significance of Juneteenth, as well as the coalition's fight to save Moses Cemetery and the related conflict with Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin.
Do you think a lot of the Juneteenth celebrations have been toned down into just kind of street parties and have lost their original meaning, or do you think they've been pretty consistent about getting certain messages out that are political?
I think it's an interesting question. First of all, Juneteenth is obviously very important. It signaled the ability of Black troops to interfere and break up a system that was designed to force people into submission. And the troops in Galveston, I don't quite buy the idea that